We ended up talking about the Kingdom Animalia and talking about some of the characteristics of the Kingdom Animalia as far as classification and as well as characteristics. And the first phylum that we want to talk about within the Kingdom Animalia is the phylum Porifera. The phylum Porifera are sometimes what we call the sponges. Now, typically when you think of sponge, what do you think of?
Cleaning.
Okay, something you clean your table off with. And probably the sponge that you clean your table off with is a synthetic sponge. It's something that humans have made that mimic real sponges. How many of you, though, have a bath sponge in your bathroom? It's a real nice sponge. Nobody in here? Usually they're, you know, $5 or $6 for a sponge. Have all of you seen those before? They're actually true sponges, and really, if you use those in your bathroom, in your tub and so forth, you're really washing your body with a dead animal, okay, in all reality. But the sponges are a very primitive group of animals. They have no tissue-level organization. Remember last time we talked about diploblastic versus triploblastic organisms? These organisms have no tissue-level organization, so they're very, very primitive. And remember, we said that animals are able to move at some point in their life cycle. Well, the sponges do that, but it's for a very short period of time in their life cycle. The sponges are basically found in aquatic environments. Most of the time, we think of sponges growing in marine environments. However, we do have freshwater sponges that live around here as well. The sizes of sponges can vary quite greatly. Some of our freshwater sponges are less than a centimeter in diameter, okay? And you can get some sponges in marine environments that are as large as a 55-gallon barrel. All of you know what I mean by 55-gallon barrel, a big oil drum. They can get to be that large. So there's quite a bit of variability in size. Mostly we find the most sponges in warm waters, especially warm marine environments. So for example, in the Caribbean, there's a lot more sponges than there is, say, for example, on Antarctica, okay? And so the vast majority of sponges are found in kind of warmer ocean types of environments. If we look at the structure of the sponge, sponges are basically, as adults, what we call sessile filter feeders. What sessile means is that they don't move, okay? So as adults, they do not move. They basically attach to some substrate, and what they do is they filter food out of the water, okay? So they filter very, very small particles out of the water. The food that sponges feed on can be as small as bacteria or just small pieces of organic material within the water. So the food that they feed on is actually very, very small. And if we look at the structure of the sponge, there are a couple of cells that become very important. Probably the most important type of cell in a sponge are these cells right here called choanocytes. Okay? And the choanocytes are a little bit different than most other cells that we've talked about. What they do is they have a single flagellum, which is not really unique, but surrounding that flagellum they have some structures that are very similar to cilia. And so they have a collar of cilia around that flagellum. And sometimes these cells, another common name for them is collar cells, because they have that collar of cilia around the flagellum. Okay. Now, basically the way that the sponge functions as far as filtering its food, getting rid of waste, exchanging gases, remember all animals are heterotrophic, and so they all respire, so they all need oxygen and give off carbon dioxide and those types of things. Pretty much all of that occurs because of the choanocytes, or collar cells. These collar cells line the inside of the sponge, as you can kind of see depicted here in this picture. And there are cells that actually cause pores to go through the entire sponge. And what happens is the flagella of these choanocytes are constantly beating back and forth. And what they do is they cause water currents to move the water through the sponge. Now, this is very similar to something I'm going to give you as an analogy, or kind of as something similar that occurs. Most of you have sat in a bathtub before, right? And when you sit in the bathtub, you can actually just move your finger back and forth, and pretty soon what will happen in that bathtub?
Waves.
Okay, there'll be waves, but there'll also be water current. It'll start circling the water throughout the tub. Does that make sense? That's kind of similar to what's happening with these clinocytes. As all of these flagella beat, the water currents start to move water into and through the sponge, and then eventually the water leaves the sponge, at least in this type of sponge that's depicted here, through the top of the sponge right here. So the water comes into the sponge, kind of runs through the sponge, and then leaves the sponge through the opening at the top of the sponge. Some sponges have multiple openings, but the water eventually leaves the sponge. Now, as that water moves through the sponge, basically that's how the sponge functions, because what happens is as water passes these choanocytes, particles that are in the water, food particles and so forth, are filtered out using the collar cells or those ciliated cells. Okay? So as water passes these choanocytes, the food particles are collected or captured, I guess you could say, in the collar of the choanocyte. Okay? And then those food particles are moved via ciliated action towards the body or main part of the choanocyte cell where the food particles are phagocytosed. You remember when we talked about phagocytosis, that's when the cell actually kind of surrounds a food particle and brings it inside of the cell. That's basically how they get the food, the filtered food particles, inside of the cell. And digestion occurs inside of the cell, which is a type of ingestion, which we said that all animals ingest their food. And then nutrients from those digested food particles can be transferred to different parts of the sponge. In addition, there's going to be digestive waste, just like with any other animal. There's waste that's produced just simply by digestion, right? And that waste is simply released or exocytosed using these collar cells. And that waste is basically put into the water, and those water currents take the waste away from the sponge. In addition, as the water passes these cells, respiration basically occurs. So these cells are using oxygen, giving off carbon dioxide. And so what happens is when new water comes in, relatively speaking, it has a relatively high concentration of oxygen, which diffuses into the collar cells, and the relatively high concentration of carbon dioxide within the cell because of respiration diffuses out into the water and is carried away. And so basically the movement of water currents through the sponge allows for respiration to occur. Okay? Any questions about that? Okay. Sponges will also produce kind of protective types of structures that are found within the sponge. These protective structures are called spicules. Okay? The spicules are these kind of triangulated or triangular structures that you see here. And basically what they are is they're made up of calcium carbonate and silica and other substances that are filtered out of the water using the collar cells. So they'll filter out calcium carbonate, silica, and other particles. And then they, on the inside of the sponge, they'll actually fuse them together. And when they fuse them together, it produces these spike or pointy-like structures that we call spicules. And in addition, other toxic substances can be filtered out of the water and stored around these spicules. So if you were to go and grab a sponge, just pick a sponge up and squeeze it real hard, these spicules might penetrate your skin. In certain areas of the world, there will also be other toxic substances that may be stored around those spicules. So grabbing a hold of a sponge could actually kill you. Okay? It could introduce toxic substances into your body. So they use that as a protective mechanism.
Does it depend on where they live?
It does. It depends on where they live and what substances are in the water. For example, around here where we have freshwater sponges, they still have spicules, but you could pick them up, and even if they cut you, it probably wouldn't cause you.
Where out here do they have freshwater?
Pretty much in most of the streams and lakes and stuff, yeah. Yeah. If you know where to look for them, they're really quite small. They're hard to see. So. When they actually use sponges for bath sponges, for example, there's not spicules in them, right? And what they do is they actually have sponge farms that they grow sponges for to sell to people for bath sponges. And what they do is when they harvest those sponges, they actually put them on a conveyor belt and smash the sponges, which basically pulverizes the spicules, and then they wash the pieces of spicule out of the sponge and so forth. Okay. Any questions about those the sponges, how they function? So this is a typical bath sponge here. This is a little bit more complicated sponge than what was depicted in the previous picture. You can see these large holes here. That's where the water exits the sponge. Some sponges have multiple exit points for the water. But then you also see all these little tiny holes throughout the sponge. That's where the water is pulled into the sponge because of the action of the choanocytes or collar cells. Okay. This is a freshwater sponge, and this particular sponge is green, so you might think that it photosynthesizes. But actually, what it is, it's a sponge that has a symbiotic relationship with green algae, and so the green algae and the sponge live in very close association with each other, and so it looks like it photosynthesizes, but it's actually green algae that's living right with the sponge. Just another picture of a sponge here. The last thing I want to talk about with sponges is how they reproduce. Sponges can reproduce both asexually and sexually, okay? We'll find this is true with some of the animals. Some animals can reproduce both asexually and sexually. There are two different ways in which the sponges can reproduce asexually. One way is by just simply a piece of the sponge breaking off. Because each of these cells, there's no tissue level organization. If a piece of the sponge breaks off, what's going to happen if it lands in a suitable environment, it may be able to grow. Okay. Other sponges will actually produce cells that are found kind of within the body of the sponge, and they're kind of like a seed. They have a protective coat over them. This is what happens a lot with freshwater sponges around here. They'll have these little pieces of the sponge that have a protective covering around them, and then what happens with most of our sponges around here in our streams dry up in the summer and they also freeze up in the winter, right? And so the sponges essentially die over those two periods of time. And then when they become rehydrated, those little pieces of sponge on the inside with a covering around them, once they become hydrated again, they can actually start to grow and grow a new sponge. Okay, and that's also a type of budding. All right. Also, sponges can reproduce sexually. However, they don't have male and female reproductive structures in the sponge. The reproductive system of sponges is a little bit different than anything that we've talked about so far. And really, reproduction, sexual reproduction, occurs with the collar cells. So here we have a collar cell with the cilia and a flagellum. Okay. Now what happens is, basically, these collar cells start to go through meiosis at certain times in the life cycle of the sponge. When they go through meiosis, of course, they go from a normal 2N cell to a 4N cell. Now, when they go to a 4N cell, they actually double the amount of cilia and double the flagellum, okay, which is a little bit different. So this is now a 4N cell. And then in the first meiotic division, what happens is we end up with a cell with twice the amount of cilia, 2 flagellum, and one cell with no cilia and no flagellum. Okay. In the second meiotic division, we have 2 1N cells that have cilia and flagellum, and 2 1N cells that have no cilia and no flagellum. Okay. And these cells over here with the cilia and flagellum are what we eventually call sperm cells, because they're able to swim and then fertilize these ovum cells without cilia and flagellum. So what's so different about the sponges is their sperm and ovum cells both come from the same original cell. The only difference is that sperm cells, what we call sperm cells, have cilia and flagellum, whereas the ovum cells have no cilium, no flagellum. Any questions about that? So then, These ciliated and flagellated cells are released from the sponge. They swim out in the open water. They'll eventually swim into another sponge and fertilize one of these ovum cells, and then a new larvae can be produced. The larval cells actually are ciliated and have a flagellum. You can see the cilia here where the light's being reflected from the light microscope. They also have cilia around their body, and this is the part of the life cycle when they're mobile for a short period of time. And basically what they do is they swim around, find a suitable environment, attach themselves to that environment, and then start to grow. Okay. Any questions about that? This is just a picture of spicules really close up. You can see the structure of the spicules. Now sponges, one last thing that I want to talk about with sponges is sponges are actually very important in ocean environments, especially from an ecological standpoint. What they do is they help to clear up turbid waters. Okay. Does anybody know what turbidity is in the water? Okay, rocks do move around when the place becomes, and that causes turbidity through wave action. Basically, you've all seen water that's really clear, right? And you see water that has all sorts of gunk in it, kind of cloudy water. Cloudy water would be considered to be turbid water, okay? So turbid water has a lot of junk in it. And what happens is sponges clear up those particles in the water or filter out those particles in the water. And the water where sponges are found can become very clear. Now, some of you may have done this in person, but say, for example, down in the Caribbean, off the coast of Florida, you can actually rent a glass-bottom boat and go for a glass-bottom boat ride, right? Or if you go to Cancun, you can snorkel out in the ocean and see clear to the bottom of the ocean, right? It's very, very clear. And the reason why those areas are clear is because of the sponges in the area. It's been about 10 years ago or so now, there was a big hurricane that came through the Caribbean. Called Hurricane Hugo and hit Florida and so forth. And after Hugo hit, the whole Caribbean was very, very turbid. And over a year after the hurricane, you couldn't go out in a glass bottom boat ride or go to Cancun and, you know, look clear to the bottom of the ocean. And tourism started to fall off in those areas because of that. And so politicians got involved in decided that they needed to determine why the water was so turbid. And what they found was that when the Hurricane Hugo came through, it caused the ocean to be so disturbed that it basically knocked off most of the sponges off of their where they were attached and washed them out into the open ocean, and so there was no sponges. And it took almost 3 years for the sponges to actually recolonize those areas and for the water to become clear again. Okay. So sponges can be very important from an ecological standpoint. Right. Any questions about sponges? Okay, the next phylum then that we want to talk about is the phylum Cnidaria. The phylum Cnidaria, and notice that the C is silent when you say the word. The phylum Cnidaria include organisms such as your coral, your jellyfish, and your Portuguese man-o-war. Okay? These organisms are still fairly primitive animals. And I should have mentioned, before I talk about Cnidaria, one other thing I wanted to mention with Periphera, and I don't think I mentioned it, was they have no tissue-level organization, and they also have no symmetry. So you didn't hear me tell you that they were radially symmetric or bilaterally symmetric. But the phylum Cnidaria, which includes the jellyfish, the corals, and the Portuguese man-o-wars, all of these organisms are radially symmetric. Okay, so their body plan is a radial body plan. So if we were to talk about directions in the Cnidaria, we would talk about the oral and the aboral end of the organism, for example. In addition, with the Cnidaria, they only have two tissue layers. So they are diploblastic. So remember, we talked about triploblastic organisms, and in triploblastic organisms, we could have acelomate, pseudocelomate, or celomate characteristics and so forth. None of that applies to these organisms. They only have two tissue layers during development. And so they're fairly primitive from an evolutionary perspective. When we look at a cnidarian, cnidarians have one of two body plans, and most cnidarians will have both body plans at some point in their life cycle, but not all cnidarians. Okay, there, the two body forms that we can find in the phylum Cnidaria are the polyp and the medusa form. The medusa form is sometimes what we call the jelly form. Okay, most of you have seen pictures of jellyfish, or you might have seen jellyfish before. They have the medusa body form. Now, in the medusa body form, typically these organisms are mobile. So when they're in the medusa form, they can kind of undulate their body and move from one place to another in the water. And they're typically carried about with water currents as well. Okay. In the polyp form, you'll notice that the mouth is pointing up in this direction. In the polyp form, they typically attach to some substrate, and they're sessile in the polyp form. Okay. Now, there are some exceptions to that. There are some polyps that can actually move. For example, there's some freshwater cnidarians that we have in some of our waters around here, and the polyps will actually somersault along the bottom of the stream or along the bottom of the lake. Some other polyps can actually inchworm along. Y'all understand what I mean by inchworm? Just kind of, you know, contract their body and release it and kind of move along across the substrate. But most polyps are sessile. Okay. Any questions about that? Now, the body plan of the cnidarian is actually very primitive or quite simple, whichever terminology you want to use. One thing that you'll notice here is on both of these pictures, you'll notice there's a mouth, but there's no anus. Notice that on these pictures? Normally, we think of a digestive tract as we normally think consists of a mouth and then an anus, right? So the food, the undigested food goes in the mouth, and then the digested waste usually exits out the anus, right? When we think of a digestive tract. Well, that's not true with the cnidarians. The cnidarians, this type of a digestive structure that they have is what we call a gastrovascular cavity, okay? Gastro meaning food, vascular is movement of oxygen, okay? So our vascular system moves oxygen, our blood and so forth. And so these are gastrovascular cavities. They are what we would call a blind-ending cavity or a sac-like cavity, okay? If you think of a sac only has one opening, right? Okay, as long as it doesn't have a hole in the other end, but you know, if it's a good sac, it only has one opening. So these are what we would call a gastrovascular cavity. And what happens is the food moves into the mouth, and digestion occurs within this cavity here, in this gastrovascular cavity. The digestive waste is actually spit back out of the mouth. Okay, so they basically defecate out of the same opening that they eat with, if you want to think of it that way. In a lot of the older texts, when I actually, you know, I'm not extremely old, but I'm older than you guys, right? In some of the older texts, they used to label this a mouth slash anus. In most of the texts today, they just call it a mouth, okay? But it has basically both functions. So food is just basically taken into the gastrovascular cavity. After digestion occurs, the digestive waste is actually spit back out of the mouth or exits out of the mouth. All right? Any questions about that? Now, this cavity also has another function, the vascular part of the function. These are animals, again, they respire, so they take in oxygen, give off carbon dioxide. And gas exchange occurs simply around the edges of the organism by diffusion. And then as food is taken into the gastrovascular cavity, water is also taken in with the food, and gas exchange occurs by diffusion within the gastrovascular cavity as well. Okay. So they don't really have a respiratory system like lungs, something to exchange oxygen. But what they do have is they diffuse, gases are diffused both on the outside of the body and within the gastrovascular cavity. Okay. Any questions about that? Now, a third function of the gastrovascular cavity is it also provides some support for these organisms. And it provides what we call a hydrostatic skeleton. Okay. Hydro means what? Okay. So the skeleton is provided by the water and the pressure, essentially, of water. That's what static means, is pressure. So what happens is water gets into this gastrovascular cavity, and the water inside of the gastrovascular cavity gives the organism some structural support. Okay. Maybe the best example, or this isn't a really good example, but if you have a balloon that's not blown up or doesn't have water in it, it doesn't really have any structure, right? It just kind of bends any which way. You can twist it, right? It has no structure at all. But you can actually give balloons a hydrostatic skeleton. If you fill a balloon up with water, it then has structure, right? Okay? It's kind of hard. It gives the balloon shape. And that's kind of similar to what's happening in the gastrovascular cavity here. As water gets inside of that gastrovascular cavity and gives these organisms some structural support. Okay? Any questions about that? So it also provides for the hydrostatic skeleton in these organisms. Some of the polyps will actually pick up calcium carbonate out of the water and produce a structure that surrounds the polyp, which makes the polyp a little bit harder, such as in the corals. Okay? But most of the cnidarians don't do that. Alright? Any questions about that? Now, if you lose the water out of the hydrostatic skeleton, I should mention this. If you lose the water out of the hydrostatic skeleton, do they have any structure at all? They actually don't. Have any of you ever picked up a jellyfish out of the water before? If you pick them up, what do? They just kind of conform to the shape of your hand. It's kind of like picking up a wash rag out of the water. When you pick a wash rag up out of the water, it just kind of conforms to the shape of your hand. Does that make sense? Same thing is true with the cnidaria. They don't have any true skeletal structure, but the hydrostatic, or the water inside of the gastrovascular cavity when they're in the water, gives them some structure. Okay? But if you pick them up out of the water leaks out of the gastrovascular cavity, out of the mouth, and it basically, then the organism has no structure at all. Okay. Any questions about that? So this is an example of a medusa. Okay. What you would typically think of as a medusa. And this is an example of a polyp here. Okay. This is an example of a polyp. Polyps can actually have different parts to them. This is actually the feeding part of the polyp right here. This is the reproductive part of the polyp that you can see with the little buds there. Most cnidarians have the same type of life cycle. Okay? They have a part of their life cycle in which they reproduce asexually, and a part of their life cycle in which they reproduce sexually. Right? And what typically happens in most cnidarians is during the polyp stage, they reproduce asexually. Okay? So these little buds right here are what we call medusa buds. What essentially happens is asexual reproduction occurs by budding in the polyps. And these medusa buds are going to be released out into the open water. Okay? Now, each of these medusa buds are going to become a new medusa. And each of the medusa are either male or female. And then in the medusa stage, the medusa produce gametes, sperm and ovum, and those sperm and ovum fuse out in the open water. Okay? After they've been released by the medusa. So in the medusa stage, they're typically sexual. In the polyp stage, they're typically asexual in reproduction. Okay? Any questions about that? Now, one characteristic that all cnidarians have is they have some specialized cells that are basically found throughout their body that are called Up here it says they're stinging cells, which is true. But these cells are called cnidocytes. Okay. So this cell is what we call a cnidocyte. Now, what is unique about this cell is the cell is kind of hollow on the inside. It has a little hollow area on the inside of the cell. It also has a trigger that is called a cnidocil. And inside of this hollow part of the cell, there is a rope-like structure that is called a nematocyst. So this whole rope-like structure is a nematocyst. Okay. And what happens is when something comes in contact with this cnidocil, this rope-like structure, or the nematocyst, is released or thrown out of the cell. Right? And that helps either to defend them from predators or to actually help them to catch their prey. And these cells are found all over the body of the organism. Some cnidarians even have them inside of their gastrovascular cavity. But where you find the greatest concentration is in the tentacles of the cnidarians. If you look here at this polyp, you can see the tentacles here. Okay. If you look at the medusa, you can see the tentacles here. Does that make sense? And that's where you'll find the greatest concentrations of cnidocytes. Okay. These cnidocytes many times will have either toxic substances, and most of them are electrochemically charged as well. Okay. And so that's why we call them stinging cells. All right. Now, some of them have substances that are toxic, as I just mentioned, which if you were to run into these organisms, it could actually kill you with the toxins there. Most of them, however, what they do is they just have an electrochemical charge that occurs across the nematocyst that's released when they come in contact with something. Okay. Now, if you remember, we talked about electrochemical gradients when we talked about how muscles work. Remember that? We said that the way that muscle cells and nerve cells work was that we had a plasma membrane, and on one side of the plasma membrane we had less positively charged ions than on the other side of the plasma membrane. Remember that? And then the way that a muscle works is there are some gated protein channels, and when the diffusion is allowed to occur, then it offsets that negative or positive characteristic of the cell. Does that make sense? Well, the same thing occurs essentially in cnidarians, in these nematocysts, or in these cnidocytes. And when the nematocyst is released, there's an electrochemical charge that's also released with that nematocyst. And that electrochemical charge shocks, and some of these shocks can be very extreme. They can be so extreme that they can cause your heart to fibrillate, which means what? Not beat normally. Okay. It can be as strong as sticking your finger in a light socket or touching a live wire. Some of these burns are so severe, some of these electrical burns. There are some jellyfish, for example, off the northern coast of Australia called the box jellies. They're probably considered to be the most deadly jelly in the world. If you come in contact with a box jelly, those cnidocytes release so much electrochemical charge that it can actually burn your body electrically. Okay, and you can actually find pictures on the internet and, you know, on National Geographic and so forth, showing where people come in contact with the jellyfish, and where they come in contact with them, it looks just like somebody burned them with a torch. It's an electrical burn, okay, and it can be very severe. Third degree electrical burns, essentially. Okay. Any questions about that? Now, the way that the nematocyst works is, again, they use this for both catching prey or food and also for defense. If there's something very, very small, like a small, what we call a copepod, a small crustacean type of an organism, when they come in contact with the cnidocil, the nematocyst is thrown out, and if it's a smaller structure, it will actually wrap around the prey. Probably the best analogy I can give you is it's very similar when you look at these underneath a microscope. It's very, very similar to like Indiana Jones. All of you have seen Indiana Jones before, right? When he throws his whip and his whip goes and hits the tree and does what? Wraps around the tree, right? Kind of similar to that. And then they'll actually pull those food particles towards their body. If they come in contact with something larger than the nematocyst, like your hand, if you were to touch a jellyfish, what would happen is it would be like throwing a whip or a rope into the wall. The nematocyst would just kind of go up against your hand and then fall, then it would recharge and discharge again. And they can recharge and discharge in millions of seconds, okay? And so you can get shocked multiple times.
How does it charge up to actually, is it like actual electricity or is it something?
Yeah, it's electrochemical gradient. So it's very similar to the way that your muscles work. Okay. So basically they're moving positively charged ions to opposite sides of a plasma membrane through active transport. Some of these cnidarians can get very large. We'll talk about one called the Portuguese man-o-war. Portuguese man-o-wars can have, they'll have a big old mass of tentacles. You'll see some pictures here in a minute. They'll have big old masses of tentacles that can be up to 20 feet long. And if you were to swim into something like that, of course they have no skeletal structure, so they just kind of conform to your body, and these charges would constantly, or cnidocytes would constantly charge up and release, charge up and release, and so it can kill you. Okay. In Hawaii, there are quite a few Portuguese man-o-wars, and there are a few deaths every year around the Hawaiian Islands that are attributed to Portuguese man-o-wars. However, we don't know for sure if they're actually from Portuguese man-o-wars. The question is always, did the swimmer or person swim into the Portuguese man-o-war and drown because they were being stung? Or did they drown and then their body float into a Portuguese man-o-war, right? So that's always the question. But they're suspected for a number of deaths in certain waters of the world. Okay. Any questions about the cnidocytes, how they function? So this is just a close-up view, a microscopic view of a cnidocyte. You can see the cnidocyte itself here with the hollow part of the cell, and here's the nematocyst out here. Okay. Any questions about the cnidarians? Now within the phylum Cnidaria, we're going to talk about three different classes. If you remember our taxonomic hierarchy, we had kingdom, phylum, class, okay? So these are classes within the phylum Cnidaria. There are three classes within the phylum Cnidaria that we're going to talk about. The first is the class Scyphozoa. The class Scyphozoa are sometimes called the true jellies, okay? And the class Scyphozoa, the thing that makes them different from the other two classes is about equal parts of the Scyphozoan's life cycle are found in the polyp stage and the medusa stage. So a normal Scyphozoan will live about half of its life cycle as a medusa stage and half of its life cycle as a polyp stage. That makes sense to everybody? Also, we only find Scyphozoans in marine environments. There's one other group, one other class of cnidarians that we'll only find in marine environments, but the Scyphozoans are only found in marine environments. Okay. So just some pictures of some Scyphozoans. The medusa that we looked at before, the picture of the medusa or this jelly here, this is a true jellyfish. Some of them can get fairly large. Some of the jellies will be, you know, 1.5 feet across type of a thing. That's a very large jelly. Some of them are not quite as large. The next class that I want to talk about just briefly is the class Hydrozoa. The class Hydrozoa, the thing that makes them different is that they have, most of their life cycle is spent as a medusa, and a very small part of their life cycle is spent as a polyp. And the Hydrozoans can be found in either marine or freshwater. We do have some Hydrozoans in freshwater environments around here. The class Hydrozoa also includes the Portuguese man-o-wars that I was mentioning. This is a picture of a Portuguese man-o-war. One thing that's a little bit different about the Portuguese man-o-war medusa-like structures is they actually, the bell, like the bell part of the medusa, actually closes up and they trap air in the bell. And so the bell is always floating on the surface of the water. You can see that here. Here the bell is actually closed. Does that make sense to everybody? Where they get their name from is the, I guess people used to think that they looked like the Portuguese conquistador helmets with the little fin on the top. Okay. But also look at this mass of tentacles. And these massive tentacles, as I mentioned, can sometimes be up to 20 feet long. And so with that mass of tentacles, if you were to swim into it, you would be in some real trouble.
How big is that right there?
That one right there is probably about, the bell part's probably about like that. But the tentacles can be very, very long. And by the way, we don't have Portuguese man-o-war in freshwater environments. In fact, the hydrozoans that we have in freshwater environments are actually quite small, both in the polyp and the medusa stage. Those of you that are in lab might see some of them, but a large freshwater hydrozoan might get to be, you know, the polyp might get to be that large. Most of them are almost microscopic. The last class within the phylum Cnidaria that we want to talk about in here is the class Anthozoa. The class Anthozoa includes your corals and anemones. Okay. Some of you have seen sea anemones before. They belong to this particular class. And the thing that makes the Anthozoa different from the other two classes, well, first of all, Anthozoans are only found in marine environments. But in addition to that, the Anthozoa do not have a medusa part to their life cycle. They only live in the polyp form. Okay, so they are always sessile. So this is an anemone here. This particular anemone is one that has the common name of a powder puff anemone. It gets its name from the tentacles around the mouth region. They look like a powder puff. You ladies don't use powder puffs anymore, but when I used to watch my grandma put on her makeup, she used to take the powder and powder her face with the puff-like thing. Okay, that's where the name comes from. Some of the anemones are quite beautiful, such as this anemone here. You might have seen anemones in saltwater fish tanks before. They're quite a common organism that they have in there. This is a coral. This particular coral is a soft coral. Not all corals collect calcium carbonate to kind of produce a skeletal structure around them, but some of them are soft corals. This particular coral is a hard coral here. It's one that they call a fan coral. You can imagine why it looks like a fan. Okay. Any guesses to what this coral's called?
Brain.
It's a brain coral. Yeah, it looks like the fissures of a brain. This is actually, this particular piece of coral and the last one that we looked at are actually dead. They don't have really any living parts to them. This is just the skeleton that's left afterwards. And coral, after coral dies, it builds up, and new coral usually grows on old coral. And that's the way that we get coral reefs. Okay, you might have heard of before. This particular coral here is what they call staghorn coral. It looks like the horns of a stag or the antlers of a stag. And this particular group of corals, the staghorns, are responsible for many of the shipwrecks throughout the world. A lot of people, at least in, well, it happens sometimes today, but you know, back when they had wooden boats and sailed into these tropical islands, sometimes the wooden boats, the bottoms of the wooden boats would get ripped out, and they'd be ripped out by coral such as this, so it's a hard coral. Okay. Any questions about the Anthozoa? Okay, again,